Accession number 29076, reel 5, reel 6.
For the rockets, we got the army to tow some old tank hulks up onto the range where they were dumped. They'd had their engines and anything valuable taken out of. They were old Shermans, I think, American tanks, but everything of value had been taken out of them. And so the chaps with their two, I think they were 10-pound practice rockets, I think they were 10 or 8-pound, used to come round and practice firing at these tanks. And some still caught fire because there was so much oil and stuff around, but directly the firing had ceased. Somehow the local what were they called, the local Arabs, I forget now, they used to sort of appear from behind sand dunes and odd little scattered villages around, and appear in their masses and pick up the bits of shattered cordite that hasn't caught fire from the rockets and were lying around. They used to put those in their galibiers and eventually get them up into Egypt where they could be given to the chaps who were blowing up our people up in the days when we were had a mandate in Palestine called in those days. Yeah.
Nigel Rose, reel 6.
Sorry, I must be running out of... is that all right? I've just about finished now. Because there's only to say that in the end... one or two other things, perhaps, from your point of view. Our courses of I think there were about 20 chaps on each course. They used to be let off at weekends, and they practically almost to a man went into Cairo and obviously visited nightclubs and things like that. And I remember one of them coming back with a black eye one morning, and apparently he'd gone to the Auberge de Pyramid or whatever it was and seen a girl there he thought was extraordinarily nice looking, and asked her to dance. And the next thing he knew, he was on his neck in the sand outside, because it was one of Farouk's special girlfriends, apparently. That was King Farouk in the days of pre-war Egypt. Just post-war Egypt, I suppose. Almost post-war. Yes. We had amazingly level weather, almost wall-to-wall sunshine every day, until we got fed up with it, absolutely fed up. And then there was a wonderful day in about October, November, when there was a little sprinkling of rain. Everyone used to dash out in their clothes and absolutely savour it. To have be wet with rain was wonderful. And then there was a little bit of spasmodic rain, just occasionally, one or two heavy bursts, but not much, until about February. And then it all dried up again, and you had wall-to-wall sun again until the following season, you know. I don't know how they stand it, really, with so much sun.
How much contact were you able to have with your family?
With the family back here? Air letters, which are now known as blueys, I think, when you send them to your friend, your family in Afghanistan and so on, they, funnily enough, they looked very like the ones they have today. The average was about 4 or 5 days, which is pretty good, I think, especially as we were a desert station. And there was one amazing day when I got one in 2 days from Newcastle, I think. I mean, 2 days. And admittedly, the war had left North Africa by then, so I suppose it got down there fairly smartly. But even so, I mean, that is astonishing. I went back on this course May, wasn't it? I think VE Day. And called in at Malta, and then went on, stayed one night at Malta, and then went on to Lynham, and then coming back, went back the same way. Amazing, flying over the North African desert, you could still see then, that was 45, but only 3 years after the fighting in North Africa was raging, really. It was still going. There were old tank hulks out in the desert, and you could see them where they'd been abandoned and shot up, and signs of battle were still there. Mind you, I think a lot of them had been... The Arabs weren't slow in sort of taking everything that was possible to take out of these things.
How long were you in Egypt for?
Sorry?
How long were you in Egypt for after the finish of the war?
After the... when I got back off this course, it was by then end of July, I think beginning of August. So I had another 4 months there, it was 3 or 4 months. We were only doing practice flying, and I'm not sure whether the courses... I think the courses still went on. But you see, warfare in Europe had finished, and everybody was waiting for the next big bust up in Japan. Because we didn't know there was an imminent atom bomb about to be exploded, which, I mean, in a way that was so wonderful, because although poor people in Nagasaki and Hiroshima bore the brunt of it, it must have saved so many lives in the Pacific, because the Japs weren't the sort of people who were going to let go. You only got to read, you know, about the Pacific Islands. The Americans tried to take over. The slaughter was appalling, and they were quite happy to lose their lives, as the Arabs are. Well, some of them were, yes. But, so I think you've more or less had my wartime history. I've kept in touch with various organisations, but in particular the Battle of Britain Fighter Association, which I went to one of their things the day before yesterday, was it just day before yesterday, wasn't it? Wednesday. No, 2 days before yesterday. Where they had this meeting put on by our association. I think they had the blessing of the Air Ministry, because crowds of people came of very high rank with sort of stripes all the way up their arm and so on, and sort of air marshals of the Royal Air Force and air chief marshals and all these sort of people. Group captains were two and a penny, you know, sort of full colonels and things. And there were about, I think about 24 of our organisation, I think, there. And then a lot of wives, people had asked their wives along, or sweethearts, or daughters. I didn't get Jenny to come this time because she was out in Wales. But quite a lot of associated people. I think I've got the thing here. Have you ever read this book by... Be careful. Was to... this meeting, am I talking? Was to publicise, if it was possible to do further publication, the efforts that are being made to keep Bentley Priory as a memento of the Battle of Britain, because it was headquarters of Fighter Command during that period, and from there Dowding issued instructions to the sectors, and you know, the sectors came up to the chaps flying. So altogether it was a very important place, and I think it felt very sad that if there was a chance of it being, which there is apparently, of it being sold to developers who want to turn it into flats, and they want to keep it more as a museum and a place for you know, remembering Battle of Britain, and where a lot of mementos and memorabilia could be kept, and it's got a lot of it there already, of course, enormous amount of stuff. It'd be an absolute tragedy, I think, if because it must be the most valuable property. It's a very handsome building, and built in about 1815, I think, 1820. It's Georgian in looks, and set in this beautiful parkland, looking right over towards London from Stanmore, up north, near Harrow, well, further out than Harrow. And it really is a beautiful place. It would be such a shame. So I think quite a lot of people in still in the RAF, and certainly a lot of retired people, and certainly our organisation is trying hard to get people interested who might be able to produce the background to make sure that if anybody's got to pay for the damn thing, well, it better be the government, or you know, it better be helped, no doubt, by private subscriptions and things, because I don't suppose the government would want to put all that money to it, but it would be such a row politically in this day and age. But it would be a shame, I think, to sort of throw it away in that manner. What was that? That comes from my talking too much, I think.
Was there any question of you staying on in the RAF?
At the end of the war, yes. It got a, when I was out in Egypt, the AOC in Egypt wrote to quite a lot of people and said, look, chaps, the war's coming to an end. What about staying on the RAF, because we've got experience and we've got to continue after the war is over, and it would be a good thing to have people who'd seen something of it. And it was a very nice, friendly letter, but I thought, no, I don't think I will, because I think I had two reasons. One, I really wanted to get back to my family, and secondly, starting as a quantity surveyor, I felt, this was more of a peacetime career than staying in the services. One point staying in the services, which one couldn't help making a note of, was that at the end of every year, of course, in the service, you have a personal conduct report, and although I didn't have any real worries about that, it did occur to me that, supposing you went on a station where you didn't like the CO and he didn't like you, and for some reason you became a little bit at odds with each other, he could have an influence on your future career. And you see, in private life, that isn't quite the same thing as there. If you are with a private firm, or you have your own firm, or whatever it is, I mean, you can say, right, to hell with that, I'm going to do my own thing. And but in the service, you can't do that unless you're going to, of course, leave the service, which would be rather unthinkable, I think, during your career. But there was this slight feeling of, you'll certainly make a lot of friends and buddies and so on, no bother about that, I'm sure. But there was a slight danger of being at somebody else's, or being vulnerable to somebody else's influence if by any chance you didn't get on with them, if they were in a senior position. I've known one or two people. Sandy Johnson was one who, and this is between you and me, he was such a sort of nice, carefree person. I'm sure he must have rubbed up some of the old sweats who were more of people living by the rules entirely to the letter, I suppose we'd say politically correct these days, but service way correct. But one met a number of people who were nice and sort of who I felt had the right sort of attitude to life generally. Yes.
Could you explain a bit about the responsibilities of rank from
rank?
From say flight leader and squadron leader.
Well, you see, I didn't get hired as your promotion. Squadron leader, which is the same as a major in the army or a lieutenant commander in the navy. I suppose one's responsibilities in wartime in a flying unit, you see, like squadron. I mean, your responsibilities are chiefly due to your flying position. In that, as a squadron leader, you probably commanded a squadron, and if you were a flight lieutenant, you probably commanded a flight. So those were your flying responsibilities, certainly. If you were on a peacetime, if you were in a non-combatant situation, then there were things like duty officers of various things to do with stations and so on. If somebody was AWOL or something, they'd be marched in front of you on a fizzer or whatever they used to call it, on a charge, and you'd have to hear that and administer a sentence, whatever it was, confined to camp for a few days or whatever it might have been. I mean, there were worse ones. I went on a number of courts martial when I was on the training side on the OTU. Varied things. There was a theft from the NAFI. There was purloining a pupil who'd crashed and was killed, and an airman had been deputed to put his things together and for his family and had pinched something, that sort of thing. Rather nasty ones, those. Didn't have many of those, just occasionally. And then there was the odd flying one, where one pupil had collided with another, perhaps, and perhaps one of them had been crashed and killed, you see. And then you'd The court-martial would probably, in that case, consist of five people, a group captain running it, two wing commanders and two squadron leaders, the squadron leaders being the juniors. And at the end of a court-martial, the squadron leaders were always asked for their opinion. When you were discussing privately amongst the court afterwards, he was always asked his opinion first, which made one have to take the plunge. The others had the benefit of your opinion. I had one extraordinary one in Egypt where there was quite a senior officer. He was a squadron leader himself, and he was accused of being caught masturbating a dog. How they came to not to squash this one before it came up for a court-martial, I don't know. But it may have been just a dislike on the station or saying somebody was trying to get at somebody else. And, oh dear. But it was an example of one of the quaint ones that came up. But responsibilities, yes. I think during the war, a lot of attitudes were changed. I don't think there was quite so much them and us, which there obviously were in the First World War. I mean, we've only got to look at those awful cemeteries in Flanders to see all the them that were called up from Pell's regiments and all the rest, and sent over there in their droves to get over the parapet and get shot down. Dreadful. And no doubt most of them were treated pretty sort of uncivilly, I suppose. You know. But I can't say I saw an awful lot of side. I think the officers, I think, especially those who were commissioned before the war, I think they were rather more conscious of their duties as an officer in a service to fulfilling their duties in a situation where they were commissioned than possibly some of us amateurs were, because we never had sort of officer training, and maybe that was a good thing. I don't know. I think certainly you see in Bomber Command where you I think usually the captain of a bomber aircraft, however big it was, a Lanka or something like that, even if he was a sergeant pilot, I think usually he had sergeants under him. But quite a lot of sergeants flew with officer-commanded aircraft too in Bomber Command, and I think that always worked very well. I think it was no sort of, directly they were in there, they were one of the club.
Was there, or did you feel any pressure in the sense that you were tactically responsible for your flight and your squadron?
For
in the air?
I think perhaps not as much as I ought to have been, in a way. I think in a fighter it's rather difficult, because so often when things happened you became detached from the main body of your squadron, and sometimes towards the end you found that the chap who was your number two was there with you at the end of it, after you'd had a sort of dogfight or whatever. But I think, to answer your question, I don't think the response... I did take a flight across on a number of occasions during the sweep times, and I certainly remember bringing home the squadron on one occasion. But... mostly, one sort of got detached, and I don't think I was a very good nursemaid flying wise at all. Some chaps were, I say, some I never did.
What could you say on the spirit of the squadrons you were serving with?
It was always very good indeed. I never remember a sort of period of depression at all. You see, I don't think in the time of the Battle of Britain, I don't think anybody realised what it was going to be called afterwards. I mean, it just seemed the job that we'd found ourselves in. And that is true and right, as one would expect. And though occasionally one's friends and colleagues were missing due to a fight that had been during the day, I think there was no time to mope. You were up on another flight later on or something like that. And always was the thought, when during the Battle of Britain, there was always a chance they'd been shot down the channel, or, because you'd know, unless you saw him, which is very unlikely, or they may have made a forced landing somewhere in Sussex or Surrey or whatever it was. So there's always a chance they'd come coming back in somebody's car later in the day, unless they were known to have been shot up and gone in. I mean, some occasionally a plane did get seen into the sea or diving into the land, but it wasn't very often that sort of thing happened. It was more often it was out of sight to people who knew what it was all about. So on the whole, there wasn't an awful long time to mope about it, and if a chap didn't turn up, well, you began to accept it, and who knows, bad luck. I think one or two forgot to turn their oxygen on and dived out in a state of unconsciousness, and of course if they were going so fast and so low, they might never have pulled out. We're pretty sure one of our chaps certainly went in that way. He was a chap who was trained with us, but he peeled off suddenly. And Sandy mentions in that article we were reading that there were two or three completely unexplained missings in our squadron, and he wonders, you know, there whether by any chance other explosives have been planted. I never heard that story when I left the squadron, and well, we didn't know in the squadron, of course, by then. I only read it in Sandy's book and asked him about it afterwards.
What sort of attitude did you have towards the Germans you were flying against?
Well, as we said, as when we were talking earlier, I think, you know, it wasn't one of hate, or at least not in my case, or a sort of burning desire to kill them. I don't remember that. I just would like to have shot down as many planes as possible, and you know, I think that was mostly the thing. Although, as I told you, I know one or two people who would like to have written off as many Germans as he could, and that I think is probably the right attitude in a fighter squadron, really. I mean, if push comes to shove, I should think the right attitude for a fighter pilot is to be pretty ruthless and hope the other side wouldn't be too ruthless if you were in the tank.
But would that attitude lead to...
You wouldn't go and shoot a chap coming down in a parachute. Well, I'm quite certain about that. I can remember waving at one once. He didn't wave back. I don't know whether perhaps he was already dead. I don't know. But I don't think anybody in the RAF, or there wouldn't be many who would shoot at a chap coming down in a parachute. The Germans were reputed to have done this sometimes, but I don't know.
Did you ever fly with or have any experience of allies who were flying with the RAF?
Only flying with Czechs and Poles who had joined our squadron for one reason or another for short periods, not with an entire Polish squadron or Czech squadron or Canadian squadron, if it comes to that, or Free French. Just an occasional chap who joined up with our squadron for some reason or the other.
Was there any...
Poles were notoriously anxious to dispose of as many Germans as they could. I think they had every right to.
How do you view the war as a whole now?
How do I view it as a whole? It's very difficult to give a personal view of all this. I think so soon after the First World War, 20 years is a very short time in peace years. It was a bit of a shock to find all this building up so suddenly, to face us as we sort of left school and were starting our careers. But I can't remember feeling any sort of criticism of our immediate forebears about it. I think one regarded as our sort of share of things that had come our way, and you know, regard it fairly stoically. I think it's just a bit of the way the cookie had crumbled. You know. Afterwards, I think you know, one realised what a narrow squeak it had been in many ways, and heaven knows what would have happened if the Germans had decided to launch an invasion. I can't see really that we could have completely defeated an airborne invasion. Would have made a mess of it, I think, but the trouble is they had so much strength in the way of airborne troops, and our troops in Kent and Sussex and so on. I mean, could they have coped with the masses of German army descending, you know, almost minute by minute by parachutes and so on? I wonder. I think the RAF would have made a dent in them all right, and so would the Navy of any ships that were coming over. But I think it must have been a very tricky moment. And then what would have happened? I suppose after 3 or 4 years of occupation, the Americans might have landed in North Africa or something, and gradually, because of their colossal strength, they might have worked their way up through Europe and got at the centre of things. But when would that have been? I don't know. Certainly the collapse of the French was very worrying, I think. I think to have seen the sort of so-called Maginot Line disappear in a day's motoring for the Germans, and really hardly any sort of resistance that could be mounted at all, however much they wanted to, see France collapse so quickly. And then the worst time, the very worst time of the whole war, as far as I was concerned, was the towards the end of 42, I think, or during 42, when particularly when the Prince of Wales and the Repulse were sunk. Was it Repulse or Renown? But you know, the two battleships were sunk out and Singapore fell. Oh, that was dreadful. I mean, one really began to wonder how long was it going on for, and could we ever turn things round? But then there was Pearl Harbor, and after Alamein, things began picking up a bit, and bit by bit. It did go on a bit there, but still. That was very depressing, that period at the time of the fall of Singapore and the sinking of those two battleships. I don't think anybody had for one moment thought how strong the Japanese were and how weak we were in Singapore.
Nigel Rose, Reel 7. What effect does the, or did the weather have on flying?
Weather. Well, in summer weather like this, flying is delightful whatever you're doing. It's very pleasant indeed. One can't think of many things to say that are not nice. Of course, autumn weather and winter and spring. Winter by itself has to be kept by itself, because there can be some beastly weather in winter, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you never want to be flying when there's snow and too much ice around. But there again, you see, the bomber boys used to go up in ice conditions and fly across the North Sea in these terrible conditions. But we, in fighters, didn't have to do that, because we were probably grounded when it came to heavy weather. But in spring and autumn too, of course, there's foggy and lots of fog, and we can't be too exact about the type of weather, but there could be awkward weather for flying. I mean, we have these blind flying instruments, which we were talking about earlier, so that you can fly through pretty well everything, except icing in aircraft which are not prepared for it can get quite difficult, and the controls can get stiff, and it can be rather awkward, especially as your windscreen will probably get iced up too. And
What sort of effect did wind have in particular?
Well, wind, you see, is mostly a grand, what should I say, wind does affect you. For instance, I can remember winning a slow flying race once on a sort of holiday at some station I was at, and when we tried to see how slow we could fly, and the slowest won the prize. There wasn't actually, it was only a theoretical prize, there wasn't one, I think. And I was at a Tiger Moth, I think, and I got it down to about 40 miles an hour, and in a lovely strong wind, I was more or less stationary over the airfield, you see. And I mean, wind to a slow flying aircraft can be quite difficult so far as ground speed is concerned. But you see, you fly through the air due to the suction of the air flowing over your wing. You get your lift from that. So really, when you ask, you know, what's the effect of wind, it's really the effect on your position vis-à-vis the ground. And flying into a wind, as the chaps across the Atlantic must know, you know, or with the wind, I think it's mostly westerly, isn't it, the high stuff they fly at, they must come over in incredible speeds. And if they fly against it all the way over, of course, they'll be slowed down from takeoff to landing. It'll take much longer. But I suppose, so far as the air is concerned, it doesn't really make... Well, it does, yes, it must do, mustn't it? Can't think of it.
Was there an effect on manoeuvres and...
On what?
On the manoeuvring of the plane.
Well...
And the handling characteristics.
Yes, but you see, if you're flying at, say, 300 miles an hour into a 100 mile an hour wind, you're only... really flying at 200 miles an hour over the ground. But if you're flying 100 miles an hour into a 200 mile an hour wind, what should you do?